I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? Perfect organism. It's structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
Hello and welcome to episode 16 of AI Movie Night. I'm your host, Joe Simpson, and tonight we're going to be discussing the absolute classic that is Alien. I'm lucky enough once again to have two great guests joining me to discuss this classic film. The first guest is Rory Greenfield, one half of the AI Comic Pod. How are you doing, Rory?
I'm good, thanks, mate. How's yourself?
I'm very good, thank you. Thanks once again for joining me. Really looking forward to this one.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, that's great. I'm also lucky enough to be joined by an absolute legend. He doesn't come on enough pods anymore, but it's always great to hear his voice on anything from football, films, pretty much anything really. Jim Fishlock, how are you doing, Jim?
I'm very good, thanks, mate. That's a very nice introduction. Thank you very much. I'm pretty intimidated, to be honest, being on here with you guys, but this is one of my favourite films, so I'm looking forward to adding a bit of simplicity to the conversation.
Well, as you know, simplicity is genius, mate. So the more of that, the better. And no need to be nervous. I owe you big time because you were the first person to get me on an AI pod and I really enjoyed it. So thanks for coming on, mine, mate. Much appreciated.
No problem. Got an eye for talent, see, mate. That's what it is.
Oh, you're too kind, mate. You're too kind. Well, as you know, there's so much to discuss on this one. So I'm just going to get straight into it, really. So, obviously, as I've mentioned earlier, even to this day, it's regarded as an absolute classic, Alien. Why do you think it's still held in such high esteem, Rory?
I think it was kind of the pioneer of a lot of films that followed. In terms of its style, it doesn't really age, which is quite remarkable because it's almost 40 years old, which... Even thinking about when I watched it recently was just an absolute shock because it still, in parts, looks like it could have been made a few years ago. And I've seen films that look worse than it that were made recently. So there's that element of it because it's a sci-fi film that's just way, way ahead of its time. But it's the suspense and the drama and the horror element because a lot of films that followed play out like this film. And a lot of people that know film better than I do probably say that this took its influence from X film before and Ridley Scott took it from X, Y, and Z that have gone before. But in terms of, you know, modern cinema and cinema that followed, the way it sets up the suspense and the kind of sheer fear and some of the acting in it and, you know, the way it's shot, it was just quite revolutionary, really. And it still holds up that strongly today.
Yeah, no, a lot of great points there. And it's interesting you mention influences and things like that. And obviously, I'm sure we'll just touch on this later. It clearly has been influenced by a number of other films. And obviously, afterwards, a lot of films have been influenced by it. And I think one of the interesting things about it is, I think Ridley Scott said in many ways when they first got to look at the story, it was a B movie, really, in so many respects. Obviously, a lot of a lot of the things in it could be in a B movie, but I think, and obviously I know we'll be discussing this in more depth, so many of the different aspects of the film are so good that it's elevated it to this classic status. So, you know, because everything in it, from obviously the alien itself, the score, you know, the cinematography, you know, the actors, you know, it's very rare for a sort of sci-fi stroke horror film, definitely in those days, to have a cast of this caliber. You know, every role has someone who's a real top-notch, you know, character actor. And it's just, I think all those things together have elevated it to be this, obviously, this magical film. So totally agree there. What about yourself, Jim?
Yeah, I think what Rory said is spot on, you know, and like you said, every single actor and the director in this film have gone on beyond this film to have very impressive careers, making fantastic films, being in fantastic films. Again, what you say about it being a B movie, you know, you could, if you hadn't seen this and you got the sort of synopsis in front of you and you just put on Sky on the Sci-Fi channel, you could think to yourself, oh, it's one of those ropey sort of science fiction films that they put on the Sci-Fi channel. But I think it's the realism and the way the film is shot, and yeah, the way that the actors, every single one of them, you know, they bounce off each other. You know, it's very, very intense. It's a bit of a slow burn to start off with, but I think if once you've watched it through the first time, you realize why it's like that. And building up until obviously, you know, we know what happens as we get sort of an hour into the film. But I just think it's a combination of all those things. And I think I've watched this film over 10 times and I watched it again this afternoon, and it just blows you away every time you watch it.
Some great points there, you know, but from you both, in particular that one you mentioned then as well about it being a slow burner. I don't think any of the sort of most memorable sort of scary, you know, frights or anything to do with the alien really happens until, you know, well after half an hour, if I recall correctly. And I think that sort of tells you how good a film it is. You know, as we said, it had the potential to be a B movie, but actually it ended up being this outstanding, you know, I would say a masterpiece of film. And I think that's evident in the fact that half an hour, it doesn't have any of the things you'd expect, you know, in terms of the alien itself, but you just can't take your eyes off it. And as you mentioned, even without the alien, the score and sort of the claustrophobic setting of so many parts of their spaceship, you know, these small rooms and things like that, and also the sort of, you know, the little tensions that are built up between the characters help it to be so watchable before you even get to actually the, you know, the real alien scenes of the film. So no, totally agree with you.
That's a great point, that is, Joe, with the, you know, by the tension between all the characters, because you just get the feeling that if the alien doesn't get involved, it could go another way, the film, in that something's going to happen amongst the group. You know, they're at each other's throats. They're not as a tight unit. Now, whether that's obviously because they've been away for so long, or the fact that they get woken up, you know, mid sleep as it is, and that sort of riles them up, I don't know. But yeah, you just get the feeling there's like an undercurrent between them all. But again, that just adds to the tension, because if you're watching it for the first time, you're not quite sure what's going to happen.
True, and I think in a lot of those maybe more B movie type films, speaking for myself anyway, a lot of the time, you have no interest whatsoever in the characters. They're sort of so throwaway, you know, they're not believable at all. Whereas these, you know, you've got these, like, you know, even just things like you've got the two guys who are sort of moaning about their wages and trying to get extra money, and that it's so real. They feel like real people, don't they? Whereas in those other films, there's nothing there normally. Whereas this, you know, everywhere you look, there's something really watchable about it, and I think that all comes together to make it so great. I'm now going to look at basically the first time you both saw the film, really. So can you remember when you first saw it, Jim, and what impression it made on you at the time?
Well, I wasn't born when it first came out in 1979, so I don't remember the first time. It definitely wasn't in the cinema, obviously. But if I had to make an educated guess, it's probably about the age of about 13 or 14, where, I don't know if it was the same for you guys, but there used to be video shops of sort of disrepute in and around the Cardiff area, where if you sort of knew somebody that may well have been or looked 18, you could sort of get your hands on these 18 videos and videos as it was then. I'm pretty sure we went through a phase, a few of my mates, just watching sort of the scariest ones that we could get our hands on, and this was one of them. And I was just flabbergasted. You know, at that age, you don't really appreciate the quality of the film, but the Alien, I've still to this day not seen anything like it, in a film, in terms of, you know, the way it's created and the sheer sort of ferocity and the power that it has in terms of, you know, when it's on the hunt. It's a remarkable, creation.
Yeah, no, it is. You know, I think you've summed that up really well in terms of that, the alien creature itself. It's just so memorable, isn't it? And I suppose that's a great point to ask your thoughts of the alien itself, Rory, and obviously as well when you first, you know, remember seeing the film.
I you know, when you asked this question, when you emailed this across, I can't remember when I first saw it. There's something about, you know, around the kind of 16-year-old age, where I had Sky Movies, and I think they showed pretty much all the Alien films quite regularly. And I think I ended up watching like Alien Resurrection about 5 times, even though it's pretty terrible. And then Aliens, and then Alien. And I didn't watch them in the correct order at all. And they all blended together for a period of time until I watched it, I don't know, when I was about 20, when I kind of took film a little bit more seriously, do you know what I mean, and appreciate it for what it was. I'm the same. I still, when I watch this film and Aliens, I don't think much. I don't like horror films. That's my general standpoint. I like thrillers a lot, and I like things that have got that kind of level of drama and suspense and you know, intelligent kind of films. And this borders, you know, obviously sci-fi, which is one of my favourite genres, and horror. And because of the alien, and because of the setting, it's just incredible. I mean, everything you said was right at the beginning, that it is a masterpiece of film on every level, which for this kind of style, like, you know, imagine that in the 70s, like sci-fi, you know, films... I would have loved to seen that at the cinema. I still would love to see it at the cinema, in fairness. It's something that I don't think, you know, when you talk about slow burning and elements of that nature, if you watch this in the cinema, the moment, you know, well, there's a few moments, but I would have been off my seat probably. I mean, you know, Jaws was so pioneering in its kind of nature, and people afraid to go in the sea afterwards. Do you know what I mean? At the time,
yeah.
I can't imagine what this did to people when they turned the lights off at night. Do you know what I mean? It's that alien is so intimidating. It's like Jim said, it's the height and the scale of it, and the power, and just the look of it, that kind of chrome, you know, skin that it's got, and it's just so intimidating. And there's never really been anything made since that has really lived up to it, maybe by the sequel, in that style and genre. I love a lot of other sci-fi films, and they do a lot of other stories and other things, but this film just kind of crossed genres and was, as I said before, just way, way, way ahead of its time. And that's why it's regarded the way it is, and that's why if you watch it again, you know, and at some point, you know, like Terminator 2 and other films I watch with my son when I don't think it's going to give him nightmares. And he'll be the same, you know, it'd be 50 years old maybe, and it'll still have that kind of impact. It's quite incredible.
I've done the same as you, Rory, many times in when on my various recuperation periods after operations and got Sky Movies on the go, and literally it's every single one of them, even the ropey Alien versus Predator ones, downloaded and watched, because I just am fascinated by the alien. It's very, very difficult to describe the sort of the creation of it, because it's the perfect killing machine, I guess. It's the perfect, you know, it is sort of end of days thing. You know, if that got loose, or more than one of them got loose, you know, I'm glad it happens in space. You know, you can easily, sort of, you know, suspend reality because it's happening in space. But, you know, they're just, it's exceptional. There's no weaknesses to it, is there? You know, it's a fascinating creation, and it just shows, like we've all said, you know, 1979 it was made, and like Roy says, if this was in the cinema tomorrow, I'd be there in the IMAX front row. Yeah. Well, maybe not front row, but I'd be there, you know, watching it, watching probably all the first three again, definitely, because I can live with the third one. That's not too bad in the prison, but after that they get a little bit silly.
I think you allow a bad third, well, you know, moderate third film because of the two that have gone before. Do you know what I mean? It's all right, but yeah. When you start throwing in Predator, I kind of turn off. Then, otherwise,
same here. I think it, once you do that, it cheapens both the Alien and the Predator. I think. Totally agree with you both. I totally agree with you both on the Alien itself. Credit to H.R. Giger there for just this unbelievable creation. And I think one of the lines in the film from Ash is great. I think he says something like, doesn't he? Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility. And what a great line that is. Yeah. And I think it really does sum up the Alien. And interestingly, I saw something that said that. And it's amazing how these things happen. Obviously, I think as well as being an ugly creature in some ways, it's beautiful in some ways when you see it at certain angles and, like, you know, certain bits where you just see the top of its head. There's something about it, I don't know, just you can't take your eyes off it. But
it's striking, isn't it? Yeah,
very, very. And like nothing else I've ever seen. And, you know, I saw something that said, and it's funny how these things happen. Some things are just, you know, real. You know, someone comes up with a great idea, but a lot of these films, as we discuss, you know, every few weeks are about solving problems. And just one of the problems they had was, well, why doesn't someone just shoot it? And that's how they came up with the acid for blood. And that is just brilliant, isn't it? You know, just this one problem. Well, how do we solve it? And then they've created, and it just adds another layer to such a great creature. So it's just a great, great creation, as you both said. I'm now going to look at Ripley as a character and the performance of Sigourney Weaver. What were your thoughts on that, Jim?
I thought, I've watched this one again recently, and I know you're going to go on and talk about the later ones in different podcasts, mm-hmm. but comparing her performance of Ripley in the later films to this one, she's a more rounded character in this film, because she's not as traumatized, you know. Mm-hmm. she's not as guarded, you know. There's bits at the start of the film where she's almost a bit ladylike and a bit giggly, especially in the bit where in the infirmary, you know, when John Hurt's got it on his face and it's got off and they're looking for it. The face hugger, and it sort of drops down, you know, and she's all sort of, ooh, you know, which is very sort of Sigourney Weaver like, or Ripley like, should I say. And then as you're watching, as the film goes on and more bad stuff happens until, you know, right at the end where she's face to face with this creature, and you can see her evolving as the film goes on into this very, very damaged individual. And I can't blame her.
Yeah, no. So summed up really well there. Well, what about yourself, Rory? What are your thoughts on Ripley as a character and obviously the performance?
Yeah, I think it's very rare at that time probably of having kind of female lead with that much, you know, that much tenacity and fight. And, you know, obviously at first, as Jim said, kind of soft approach to it, but she definitely hardens as the film goes on, and that kind of transpires across, you know, the later films as well. She becomes, in the second one, she's pretty brutal and pretty hard. And that kind of performance, it's kind of rarely seen in cinema, probably by a female. They wouldn't have given the script and that much, I don't know, it doesn't fit of that era. Do you know what I mean? It was yeah, known for being a film that kind of pushed boundaries in other aspects, as well as obviously the way it looks and the everything else we've discussed, really. So yeah, her role is great. She's very untrusting at times, and she's quite right to be. And she's the only one that really, well, you know, there's a scene, obviously she doesn't want to let him back on board when the aliens, well, you know, attaches to his helmet or his face. And she knows the risk. She's already got that kind of air of trepidation about her. She's much more fearful than the others. They're always laughing and joking, and she's kind of not always involved with that. And she works well, you know, and that's kind of cause of friction, as you discussed earlier, between the characters. She's a big part of that. She gets a massive slap across the face from who I think is John Hurt's girlfriend, isn't it? As such, or maybe not, but you know, in terms of the other actor and not letting him back on the ship initially and stuff. So yeah, she's good. She's the antagonist. I think she's great in it, to be honest. I think it's an excellent role for her.
Yeah, no, agree with you both. They're excellent performance, and such a, you know, like you both met, I like that. It's like, it's not one note. Obviously, she's an extremely strong, intelligent woman in it, but she also has bits of where she'll show fear, understandably, and panic, and, you know, at times, you know, sheer desperation, but she keeps it all together. And I like that they show that as well. You know, they show, you know, all the different emotions you would be going through, you know, if you were in this, you know, dire situation. And I just think it's just a brilliant performance. And I like, you know, as you say, she's so intelligent and strong, and like she's the one, you know, she's got this tension, particularly with Ash, because I think she can sense something's not quite right with him. And, you know, she's the one keeping them honest, as you say, you know, she wouldn't let John Hurt's character, Kane, back on the ship, because she was sticking to the rules, and she knew what was best for them as a whole, rather than just going with emotions, as obviously the captain was. And, you know, she was the one making correct decisions, but being overruled there time and time again in the early parts of the film. And I think it's just good seeing that sort of clash between her and Ash, who I know we're going to talk about now, because that's a really interesting relationship in the film. So what are your thoughts on
the dynamic? Sorry, Joe. The dynamic between Dallas and Ash is really interesting to watch, you know, right from the very beginning. And like you say, she's constantly questioning, you know, she makes reference, doesn't she? She says, oh, surely the science officer should have, you know, certain things to say about this and that, you know, and she almost sort of steps on Dallas's toes a couple of times. But it's a really interesting dynamic, I think.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think that you've hit on something there as well. Dallas is the captain, but he's quite laid back in a lot of respects. He's firm when he needs to be, but generally he's quite laid back, whereas she's a lot more like, she doesn't just take things as read. So as an example, like when he creates the sensor, straight away she's asking him about it. She wants to know exactly how it works. You know, she's just a very intelligent person, and she expects everybody to step up and is questioning them all where necessary to try and ensure they're doing all he can do and what they're doing and how they're doing it. So yeah, no, it's an interesting dynamic between the three of them. What are your thoughts on the character of Ash and the performance of Ian Holm, Rory, and obviously that dynamic and relationship we've just mentioned?
I love Ian Holm. I think he's a great actor. I think he's pretty much perfect for this role, to be honest. I mean, all the cast are fairly inspired, but he plays that role so well, and it's quite a twist, really. Do you know what I mean? I had no real idea he was a robot throughout until it happened. I honestly, and you know, I think now in the modern era of spoilers and where everything gets reviewed everywhere, you wouldn't probably be able to keep those kind of elements secret. But in this this, it just, it really works. So he's very dry, you know, he's obviously very robotic in his approach to things, but you see him as that kind of science-based, and that kind of makes sense in his role and the way he plays it. But you just don't know what his ulterior motives are. Do you know what I mean? And I love a film that's almost got a second bad guy as such. Do you know what I mean? A second source of problems. It's that kind of twist where it's not, if one thing is going against you, that's bad enough, you know. But when you've got an outside source disrupting and making things more difficult, it just changes everything. So that role that is, you know, pretty prominent in the way the film plays out in the last kind of half an hour or so, he's very pivotal to that. And his scene, you know, when he ultimately reaches demise and his head's laid on the floor, is quite remarkable, really.
Totally agree. And I think, as you say, having that second, you know, sort of tension cause, I suppose, in and around that spaceship is it means even when there's nothing to do with the alien, you're always unsettled in some way, you know, be it by his reaction.
You're never comfortable. If that cast, you know, they have a couple of moments, well, they have one moment where they're quite happy around a dinner table for a very brief moment, because we're about to discuss that. But, but you know, they have that moment. But the rest of the time, it's always on knife edge. You know what I mean? You never feel that comfortable watching it, which is great. I think that's why it works. You know, it always keeps you on your toes after about the half an hour point. It is quite a slow build-up into it, but that's fine. It works well in the grand scheme of it.
Yeah, no, completely agree. What about yourself, Jim? Obviously, I know you enjoy those dynamics between those characters. Anything you'd like to add on that relationship at all?
I just echo what Rory said, really. I thought he was fantastic. And again, I didn't see it coming. It's almost sort of like a Star Wars sort of reveal, you know, when he sort of ends up to being this robot. And, you know, I just think they're up against this alien, this creature, which is sort of just picking them off one by one. And, you know, Dallas has obviously passed away, and Ripley heads off into sort of the unit to speak to Mother. And, of course, she finds out then that there's obviously this ulterior motive for the whole mission. And it's the reveal, you know, a little bit more of a reveal into his sort of character and the way that he's been portrayed and what his role is while he's on the ship. And I guess sort of just watching how that affects the remaining group, you know, when you think you're dealing with one issue and you know, you're all dealing with it together, to find out that actually, you know, one of the remaining people, because there's that bit at the just a couple of minutes before she finds out where they're on about just jumping into the shuttle and just, you know, blowing the ship up, you know, and Ripley says, well, we can't fit four in. Well, if she'd had that conversation 5 minutes later, I don't think fitting four in would have been an issue, you know? It is just really, really clever. Just really, really clever.
Totally agree, and great point that, as you say, it must make it all the more, you know, heartbreaking and make her all the more angry that, as you say, she was essentially putting all their lives at risk, you know, not abandoning the ship and going in the shuttle because of them being four. And obviously he's the one who's stopping that happening. And, well, one of the ones stopping it happening, and obviously he's a robot with an ulterior motive that makes them all expendable. So it just makes it, you know, even worse that he would be doing that at the same time. I like some of the little things he does as well, like the little run he does. He does a little run on the spot at one stage, and obviously that's before we know he's a robot, but watching it back after knowing that, it's just another little sign and the odd look he does. And like, some of this could obviously is not necessarily because he's a robot, but sometimes you can see little looks he's doing. They just little things to just make you more suspicious about him. Obviously, as well as those, there's quite a few characters in there that are interesting in different ways. Have you got any thoughts on any of the rest of the crew at all, Jim? Any of those stand out for you, or on the setting of the Nostromo itself?
Yeah. Do you know what? When I first start watching it, the first thing that springs to mind is how very much like Star Wars A New Hope it is, because whenever I see that, I know that it's not really in space. You know, I'm not stupid, but watching it, the way it's put together, it's not done on a green screen or not using any special effects or anything, but it looks realistic, you know, and yeah. For a split second, I could believe that that ship is in space, moving as quickly or as slowly as it is. And then when it goes inside the spaceship again, now, whether or not it's sort of my subconscious, because I've seen this film and Star Wars and others like it, and I think, that looks like a spaceship to me, and it looks real, you know, that it is tangible. The actors are touching it. They're interacting with it. And it just, the whole of the ship and, you know, the ambience for the film just goes perfectly hand in hand, I think, in terms of the set, you know, and just the way, it, you know, it's hot, it's sweaty, it's humid, you know, you know, it's dark, it's dingy. It's the perfect place, really, for any sort of creature to hide out and sort of and grow and you know, nest as we see happens later on in the film. So I think, you know, the spaceship itself adds another sort of layer to the film. But in terms of the other cast members, you know, I think Dallas is great. I think, you know, he's one of those sort of really fed up, anything for a quiet life sort of, you know, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And if it's anyone else's department, they can sort it out. Just tell me so that I can just crack on, you know, and he's, you can tell he's just really fed up and he probably can't wait to get home. But yeah. As it was, he was never getting home.
Summed up really well there. What about yourself, Rory? Have you got any thoughts on the rest of the crew or on the spaceship itself?
Yeah, I'm with Jim. I mean, obviously, I house the comic pod and we talk about very modern cinema, some a little bit older, but mostly modern. And that's all green screen or mostly. And they make it work and it is believable in its own kind of sense of things, but I like a set. So when you watch films, like Jim said, where you can feel it's almost real. Do you know what I mean? And it's the same with TV and it's the same with most things. I think a set of this scale and it wouldn't work well if it wasn't a set, because the way the camera angle is shoot things, and I'm not trying to get overly technical, it's just, you know, you can't make things appear the way they appear, and you can't, like Jim says, get those kind of senses into your head. You know, the scene when, you know, they slice the alien, you know, when it's attached to his face and the acid burns through the floor. And that's all obviously done in some capacity, probably real capacity actually. And you obviously feel that, and it's quite incredible when you watch films and you can kind of sense the heat and it's in tune with your senses, which is quite hard to get. So yeah, the spaceship's incredible. And yeah, I like Parker's character a lot. I think he's almost a bit of light relief at times. John Hurt's character, albeit isn't in for that long, but you know, still has quite a prominent role. I think they all add something. You know, there's a lot of films, sci-fi films now, where you know half the cast of fodder, basically. So if you've seen this kind of film repeated, it's not often repeated in the same way, but you know, a lot of horror films and whatever, a lot of them, you know, are just going to be picked off. And this film doesn't really initially give you that sense. They all have a bit of a role, some a little bit more prominent than others, but yeah, I think everyone, just in the way they bounce off each other, and you've got some pretty big name actors in there, do you know what I mean? And none of them have a great amount of script time, and that kind of works. It's all about the environment and the alien, really, once you get into it. So
yeah, no, totally agree. And I'm so glad you mentioned Parker there. He's one of my favourites. He really makes me laugh, and he's such a big, strong character. And Yaffa Kotto, who played him, I was reading a funny thing where Ridley Scott said when he found out he was meant to be killed off, he was like, there's no way this alien is killing me. There's no way you can kill me, this alien. And he said he had to spend ages convincing him that he had to let it, you know, had to let it beat him. And I love that type of thing. You know, I think it really shows in his performance as well, that he does always have that sort of, that attitude that he will be able to beat it. And, you know, he doesn't need anyone to help him. And, you know, I love little things like that.
I think he said during the sort of the filming of the film, Ridley Scott told him to go around and actively annoy Sigourney Weaver off the camera. So that when you see the tension between the two of them, it's very, very real, because he was a swine, apparently, off camera to us. So, yeah, just to sort of add to the authenticity of it, you know?
Oh, no. I love things like that, those little tidbits that clearly, you know, add into everything in that mix and add a whole new layer of, like, tension, as you say. Oh, that's quality. Love things like that. On the spaceship, some great points made by you both, and I totally agree that the fact that you believe it's real, it helps to immerse you so much in the film. And talking about Star Wars, it's interesting you mention that, because I think that was the first major film, or at least the first one that I am aware of, that used that sort of lived-in universe in space, you know, with the ships that look battered and dirty and look like they've been lived in and used for years. And this has so much of that in it, doesn't it? I think he got a lot of the parts from an aircraft graveyard, so the real sort of mechanical instruments, or real sort of, you know, mechanical, you know, metal walls and things to make it look like a real lived-in ship. And it really does add so much to it. Even little things, like, I think he said he wanted it to look like when they go to different places, they get little keepsakes or little things, like little gadgets, like the ducking bird, and or, like, you know, I think he's got this page free posters and things in certain things. It looks like people live in this spaceship. It doesn't just look like they've turned up one day on this set and gone, let's film this scene. It looks like a real living and breathing place where these people all exist from, you know, over many, many years while off doing this mining in space. So no,
you can tell it took time. Do you know what I mean? That there's a lot of films you watch and you read that the set time is 4 weeks and stuff. I think with films like this, obviously the production is quite heavy, especially the kind of visuals and things. But, you know, the set itself will have taken time to put together, the whole, you know, filming experience. I think they budgeted about $4.5 million, which is a lot at the time. And then it came in about $11 million because they basically trusted Ridley Scott's, you know, storyboards and thought it'd be worth the extra money. It grossed $183 million. And I presume that's to date. Do you know what I mean? I presume there's been re-releases and, you know, but for a film that cost $11 million and grossed $183, you know, films now don't gross $183 million. Do you know what I mean? It's quite great. The best thing here is that the opening weekend, it made £208. in the UK, I think that's what it says.
Oh my word!
That
is amazing.
So I think it's 208, or it might be 2008 or something. So it's one of those that it probably wasn't on initial release as big as it's become. I think it's very much a cult phenomena, but it's bigger than that. You know, it's a cult film with a slightly larger following, if that makes sense. It crosses those kind of divides where it kind of just keeps going because it's a classic. It's a cult classic, you know.
Oh, no, I love that. That's crazy, that fact about how much it took initially. Just shows you that, with such quality, I presume the word of mouth must have just spread like wildfire.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's it. I mean, big cast and you know, I'm not sure if Ridley was a big director at the time. I don't think he was.
I think it was only his second film, and I think as well most of those casts he'd done loads of adverts and things, so I think he was a really So I think all that, he knew what he was doing, obviously, as we can tell, but it was only his second film. And I think, interesting you mentioned the cast.
Imagine doing that as his second film. I mean, his third film's Blade Runner. It's quite remarkable.
It's crazy.
It's quite amazing, really. Obviously, he's gone on to have a kind of mixed career. Some people like him. He kind of, some of his films, not so much, but he still produced some incredible films.
Well, as James Cameron said, he's arguably produced two of the three greatest sci-fi films on his own. And as you say, back to back, that's incredible.
It is incredible. Yeah, it took him 5 years apart as well, so you can kind of show the dedication to it. You know, there's some directors that really do you know, work with the script and work with the casting and work with the production, and they're the ones that really make these kind of films. So yeah, it's great.
I think that leads us nicely on with us, obviously praising Ridley Scott. It leads us nicely onto the special effects in this film, and obviously he's heavily responsible for so many of them, and obviously such a great director, particularly on this film. What are your thoughts on them, Rory?
The effects are incredible. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about the visuals on the ship, particularly, but the alien alone is just stunning. And the visuals when they're going on to the bigger ship, and they come across that kind of giant alien who's kind of been fossilized. Just that scene, it just to me, is just mind-blowing that was done that long ago, really. All the scenes in space look pretty real in consideration, because it's obviously, there's some age to it. It's not made yesterday, you know? So, but the visual effects, I mean, it won an Oscar for them, and you can tell it really is ahead of its time. It probably set a lot of things for films going forward. I said it influenced a lot of films in terms of its style. So obviously, you know, the suspenseful elements, and you see so many films now that basically are a rip-off of Alien in one way or another. Even if it's a different monster, if it's a, you know, whatever it is, you know what I mean? So, But the visuals, yeah, I think visually it was just way ahead in terms of the way it used cameras on the basic point of view. From that perspective, it's using camera angles and styles that probably weren't really seen before that. And just the effects of the alien and even the smaller alien and all the other aspects to it, just stunning, really.
Yeah, no, great points there. It's funny as well. I mean, so many of us, I wonder if this is because of his advertising background maybe or what, but obviously, as you say, with a relatively limited budget for obviously the brilliance he was producing, he had to solve so many problems himself with ingenuity. And just some of them, Jim mentioned earlier on, simplicity, and some of them are so simple but so clever. Like, they had a model of the Nostromo spaceship, and to make it look bigger, he got a couple of his kids and someone else's kids to act as the sort of the people coming off the ship in this sort of spacesuits to make it look twice as big. Now, obviously, that's just such a simple technique, but it works so well. You know, doubt anyone ever looked at them and thought, oh, they're kids in those spacesuits. They just think, God, what a spectacle, do you know what I mean? So clever. Or even the egg and things like that, it's like bits of sheep. You know, insides of sheep used within sheep intestines.
I just read it before. It was four scallops, a sheep intestine, and then some kind of cuttlefish or something ridiculous.
But so clever, because when you look at it, you think, yeah, that looks like the inside of a living creature. And it's because it is the inside of a living creature. And obviously, so cheap. You know, you could have spent all sorts of money creating something, but he just does it so simply. And I've never once thought, oh, that doesn't look like it's part of the creature. It's just done so well. And I suppose the way it's shot as well, you know, one of the biggest enemies of anyone creating any creature is, how do we avoid it looking like a man in a suit? You never ever look and think, that's a man in that alien suit. But I don't anyway. It's just done so well. It's just brilliance by him. What about yourself, Jim? Have you got any thoughts on the special effects?
Yeah, I think you've both, you know, pretty much nailed it. They're incredible. You know, that scene with the eggs, you know, there's so many of them, and they all, you know, they're all sweating, they're all wet, you know, they look like they've been there for ages, and then it just opens up, you know. And even when Kane is, he's back in the ship and he's got that thing on his face, you know, and I know it's clever camera work and things, but you can see them when they start trying to pry it off initially. It tightens up around his throat. It's just very, very clever. All of it. Like you've said, it's just so far ahead of its time. It's all very, very realistic. There's obviously no green screen or anything in there. Everything that's happening feels like it's actually happening, you know, and that, uh, that, chest bursting scene was apparently done in one take with four different camera angles on it, which when you think of, you know, when you watch it, if you just focus on watching that scene, you know, John Hurt in that is fantastic. But, you know, the sort of confusion and the distress of everybody involved in that scene. And then for this little creature to just appear with those really bright, silvery sort of lead looking like teeth, you know, which look like they could do some serious damage, even though it's only probably about 8 inches tall. Yeah, it's just brilliant. Just really, really, really brilliant work.
Yeah, no, you're right. And as you say, it's 8 inches tall, but it is so scary, this little creature. And I think that's a credit, you know, sometimes, particularly with it being the small version of it, you know, sometimes in other films, if it'd done less well, that could have been something you laugh at. You know, obviously, it in a way, the whole film hinges on the believability of that scene and the special effects in it. And I don't think anyone watching that thought, that doesn't look real. That doesn't look like a real creature. And that, as you say, is such a credit to Ridley Scott, really, and his team. I'm now going to look at some of the most memorable scenes from the film. Obviously, we've touched on some of them earlier, but we'll probably look at them in a little bit more depth now. So the first one I'm going to touch on, which is, you know, one of my favourite scenes, is the thoughts on the space jockey scene. And ultimately on the facehugger attacking Kane. I'll start with you, please, Jim. What are your thoughts on this part of the film?
It's just incredible. They step off that the shuttle and they see, you know, this incredible, you know, sort of spaceship, as we find out. And, it, you know, you're thinking, what is it? You know, and it's there and they get in there and you just think, all right, okay, yeah, it's very believable again as a spaceship. You're interested to see what sort of spaceship it is, what's in there. And then, you know, as they're exploring, it pans out and you see this massive structure with this person in and it amazes me that nobody, like I'm watching it and I'm thinking, that guy in that spaceship, in that spacesuit is massive. Mm-hmm. And they sort of potter around him and none of them mention it. None of them mention and think, say, like, oh my God, I hope there's not any of these lying around you, because they're huge. They're like, you know, there's no mention of that at all. And then, you know, Kane goes off exploring, doesn't he? And that's the start of it, because it's the usual thing where he's looking down and you're thinking to yourself, don't go down there. There's nothing good down there. And if you're going to go down there, don't go down there on your own. And then it's just the builder. So you see him going down and like I say, you're thinking, don't go down there. But then he's down there and then he's sort of exploring again and you can see all these eggs. And when I'm watching it, I was thinking, that space jockey's been dead for a long time. Those eggs are just there, you know, just feeding off something. And you never quite get to see at that point what they're feeding off. But later on in the film, you get the gist of it, of what they're feeding on, you know, and how they're still sustaining themselves. And then it just explodes into action for 15 seconds. And that's the start of it all. And it's just so well done. It's paced perfectly. You know, it is literally the three of them. They're sort of a little bit excited, a little bit of trepidation. And then sort of he gets a little bit too enthusiastic, Kane, and that's it. And we all know what happens after that.
No, summed up brilliantly there. What about yourself, Rory? What are your thoughts on that part of the film?
When you watch films since, you kind of know that that's kind of classic suspense building. Do you know what I mean? I just try and always think back to what it would have been like at the time. And they would have quite innocently gone, oh, it's fine, they're just exploring the spaceship. You know, and obviously, as Jim said, they see that giant fossiled kind of creature. I'd be quite nervous at that point. It doesn't seem to faze them at all. But yeah, the facehugger, something was inevitably going to happen, but I don't think you ever saw that. And obviously, you know, you see them when they're back to the ship and they cut his helmet off. You have no idea if it's going to be attached in that way, you know, down his windpipe, you know, breathing for him. It's quite a remarkable thing, really. It sets the film up as you kind of expect it to. It's building the right kind of tension without you being ultimately, it's obviously called Alien, you know, and I'm sure the signs were there in the posters and everything else, but I still don't think you know when it's going to strike or what's going to happen. So yeah, I think that first kind of opening 30 minutes is a really good kind of setting up for what goes on afterwards.
Totally. And it's interesting you both mentioned about, you know, they don't seem too alarmed by seeing this space jockey with his, you know, something has burst out, exploded from his insides, as they call it. And it's interesting to me that in so many ways, A, just what's the backstory to this space jockey and what was he doing on this ship? But also, in that world, obviously, I am prone to getting really geeky, but in that world, what is the current level of awareness of other things out there that they don't react that big to this huge, giant figure with his insides exploded out? Do you know what I mean? So I like that there's a mystery behind his character and what his purpose was, and also just a mystery behind the universe they're living in. You know, is it like now, or as it seems in the film, they have actually had some alien contacts of some variety, clearly, but at what level and what exposure? So I find that really interesting. And I think the alien spaceship, again, credit to Geiger on this, is amazing. This sort of organic, it looks organic at times, mixed with metallic. And obviously the space jockey himself is sort of, as he says, fused into his chair. All this stuff is so unsettling to watch. And then, as you both said, then you've got this face hugger that's attached to him. And that these are all things, you know, and obviously we'll touch on it a bit in a moment, I'm sure, but invading his body and all these things together are so unsettling and just make it affect you in every way. You know, it just makes you uncomfortable watching these things and obviously seeing, you know, it's wrapped around him and it's pulling on his throat and things and feeding him oxygen. Just hits every mark perfectly, really. Obviously, I've mentioned it there. Do either of yourselves have any thoughts or theories on who or what the space jockey was, or what the purpose of this ship was, or anything like that? I know, obviously, Prometheus has gave its version. Any theories at all?
I don't like to make them, to be honest. I kind of like it to be as it is. Do you know what I mean? That's, mm-hmm. I know a lot of people would. I'm sure there's countless articles and all the rest of it at the time and now, but no, I kind of like it on its face value and not knowing, really.
Yeah, I think I like not knowing, but I like sort of wondering, really. But yeah, no, I totally agree. I would never, if I was Ridley Scott, and obviously, you know, he's such a talent, you know, credit to him, it's up to him what he does, but I would never have answered that question or tried to answer that question, because you can never create something as good as the imagination of, you know, all these different possibilities. Do you have any thoughts or theories, Jim, or are you a bit like Rory, rather just leave it as is, sort of thing?
It's very, very intriguing. And I've read sort of two or three different variations. You know, I'm just reading something from Rob Conn now, just in the background while this is going on. But yeah, very, very similar to you guys, is that, you know, the reality is that my imagination and what I think has happened is different to yours, different to Rory's and everyone else's. So how we can try and, you know, formulate a film that's going to tick all those boxes and not leave anyone disappointed is almost impossible. I'm looking forward to, you know, Prometheus was okay, and I'm looking forward to the next couple that he's going to do, but I just wish that he'd left it and let the, I can't think of the chap's name now, but the guy that directed District 9. You'll know his name, Joe, and you will, Rory. I can't think of his name.
Rory might have forgot his name now, sorry. I know
you know the chap I'm on about. He was supposed to do like a prequel, wasn't he? But I think
there is another alien film in development, but I'm not sure if he's doing it or not. It's Neil Blomkamp, South African director.
Yeah, he's taken a break because Ridley Scott wants to push on with The Covenant. And I think they were going to be sort of too similar. So he's waiting for Ridley to do his next trilogy of the Aliens, or the prequels, and then I think he's going to do his, which would, you know, is a bit sort of disappointing, really. But yeah, I think I don't know how you can, I'm not quite sure how you can put it all together in how this creature has come about. It's just, I think just leave it to the imagination.
Yeah, I think that's what disappointed me with Prometheus and the idea of prequels in general. Like, prequels in general don't often do a lot for me. Do you know what I mean? I know we can talk Star Wars and you guys have, you know, but, well, Joe hasn't, and, you know, it's difficult, isn't it, with prequels? Because it's starting to retell the story in a different way, and then it starts to affect your impact on what you think of the film that was made before it, but is after it, and all the rest of it. I've never been a massive fan of them. They're occasionally done right if it's a different story and it's the way to kind of fit certain aspects in, but it's very rarely done right. So, you know, I watched Prometheus. I wasn't a massive fan, to be honest. So, yeah, I just didn't think there was any need. I just don't think there's any need. I don't think there's any need for any more Alien films, really. I think you leave things as they are. You know, it's always seems a shame. Ridley can still make good sci-fi if you've seen The Martian. Do you know what I mean? He can still do it. And it's like, you know, different film, obviously, different style. And, you know, but it can still do it. It doesn't need to do this again. You know, that's...
I think sometimes you just got to accept that this is where it starts. You know,
this is
where it starts for this particular character, if you want to call the alien the character. Mm-hmm. We don't need to know the hows, whys, and wherefores. This is how it started, and if it goes on for another at least one and potentially one and a half very, very good films before it gets ruined because it made too much money as a franchise.
Yeah, no, some great points made by you both there, and I think I pretty much share them, really. What about, obviously, the most iconic and famous scene of the film, the chest burster scene? What are your thoughts on that, Jim? I know you mentioned it earlier on.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. It is literally how it can go from, you know, you've got the group really disappointed, really upset, really struggling to come to terms with what's happening to John Hurt's character. You know, it's all gone wrong in the space of, you know, in a very small space of time for them. They've been asleep, expecting to be returning to Earth. They've been woken up short of obviously going home. They've got a new mission, and they're there and they're thinking, what is wrong with him? What have we let onto the ship? And is he going to survive? And how are we going to sort of deal with that? To, oh my God, he's alive. He's awake. Let's all go and have one last meal before we get back into the deep freeze. And, you know, next time we wake up, we'll be back at home and cashing our checks. And, you know, Parker's considerably happy about that. And he's cracking jokes and enjoying his food. And of sort of 10 seconds, it's gone, you know, and nothing's ever going to be the same again for any of them. And because they're just workers as such, you know, manual laborers, really, you know, some of them are very intelligent in the case of Ripley, and obviously Ash. But other than that, you know, the others are just sort of manual laborers, manual workers. And to see something like that, I can only imagine the sort of distress and the trauma it would cause, not to mention it's happening to one of your friends. And it's just perfectly put together. It's just the way the atmosphere just changes in an instant, and you can see on all of their faces, you know, what has happened. We can understand it. And then they go on the hunt for this creature, which is probably the worst thing really that they could have done.
No, summed up really well there. What about yourself, Rory? What are your thoughts on this scene?
I don't think I can add much more, to be honest. Jim perfectly summed it up. I think the hunt element of it is great. It's in film world, you know, there's casualties coming. Do you know what I mean? You know they're in trouble when they go hunting an alien in the dark. And as it kind of starts to transpire, and it just gets more and more tension, and obviously more and more of them die. And all they are is hunting around in the dark with this small sensor, you know, that bleeps. Do you know what I mean? And even the scene with the cat makes you jump a little bit, probably first kind of time. There's that tension building up, all the vents and the style. And when we talked about the ship earlier, this is just the scene where you get to explore more of the ship. And yeah, it's a great period of the film. It slightly ups the pace a little bit, which I think is good, because it's just a slight shift in dynamic, because it does build when a film builds pace, it starts to build tension a little bit. It's very good. It's a very clever part of the film.
No, totally agree. And I think you mentioned it there, that sensor is such a great invention for building tension, isn't it? What about yourself, Jim? What are your thoughts on the hunt for the alien? I know you mentioned earlier on it was probably the worst thing we could do.
Yeah, I love that scene with Dallas, you know, and that just goes back to what I said earlier about him. You know, he's the captain of the ship. He's the one going in there. And you know it's coming, but they build it in such a way. And, you know, Veronica Cartwright, whatever her name is, she doesn't do much in the film, but what she does in sort of that particular section is very, very good, because she's the one that it probably affects the most. And that goes back, I think, to what Rory and yourself said, I think possibly she was, Kane's partner sort of, or love interest in the film. But, it's just when he's, you know, he's dropping down and you can see the two beeps getting closer and you're thinking, oh my God, your heart rate's going a bit when you're watching it, and you're thinking, and you're almost sort of turning away from the screen because you're thinking, well, it's going to get him.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't. And then no. And then he says, oh, I've had enough of this. And you think, oh, whew, he's got away with it. And then literally the light's on and there it is. For a split second in all this glory, ready to, and it's just, it's a killer, and it's just, you're just like, oh my God, in a way you're like, thank God it's got him, because I don't think I could put up with another sort of 30 seconds of the tension. It's a really, really good scene.
Totally agree. And I think it's so good that the way it's done, in terms of he's been so unflappable throughout and so brave and so calm. And when you see him losing his cool, as anyone would, that sort of adds to your tension, because you're like, if Dallas is losing his cool, then it really is bad. And you can see Ripley, she knows where it's going. They all know how this is going to turn out. And I think that really, you know, adds that, you know, that punishing tension, as we've mentioned. Obviously, as Rory said, I'm aware of the time. There's so much we've discussed and there's so little time. So I'd just like to ask you both before we wrap it up, if there's any moments or scenes we haven't touched on, or lines or anything like that you'd like to maybe draw attention to before we finish. Starting with yourself, please, Rory.
I think just the closing scene is excellent. So obviously Ripley comes face to face, you know, with it, and she's the only one that probably, she knows what she needs to do. She uses a brains and a nous to, well, you know, ultimately, you know, save her own life. Do you know what I mean? That's the quite incredible part of it. You know, you need someone to survive. You need something to come of it, and It's a great kind of final scene. And then, you know, the effects come into great use then. You see a lot more of the alien in those scenes when he's holding on outside, you know, he's strapped on outside the ship, and then she fires the kind of rocket boosters and fries it and stuff. I just think it's a really good close to the film as such. And then her just kind of talking her way in and leading back to Earth as such. And I just think it wraps the film up really well. I think, just briefly touching on it, I think the cut is really something quite incredible of this film, because obviously director's cuts and all various other things. I read that the full film was 3 hours 12 minutes without cuts. Wow. And it's what, an hour 57, I think, the standard kind of running time. And you can just kind of tell probably what went into it in the footage, and be much more, you know, tension if you're doing a 3-hour film of this kind of nature. But yeah, it's cut so well. Do you know what I mean? It's not a film that need, you know, there's certain films you say, oh, that bit dragged, or this bit wasn't right. It's just, it's a perfectly kind of edited and cut film. And that does go a long way, because in a film that builds tension and builds kind of on a momentum scale, it needs to be done perfectly. And that's why, you know, films that don't have that lead in at the beginning and don't play out the right way throughout just don't set that kind of tone and tension. It's majestic, really.
Yeah, you're right. It's just perfection how it builds that tension and doesn't go too far, doesn't go too short. It's just every bit is perfection. Do you have any thoughts on that final scene, or any other scenes or moments you want to draw attention to, Jim, before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I really like the final scene, and I think it's sort of fitting that it takes not only opening the sort of the hatch to get out into space, but to stick the afterburners on to get rid of it, just to show, you know, what a sort of incredible, as I've said, you know, numerous times already, what an incredible sort of creature it is. It will not give up. I like the sort of contrast when she finds him in the ship and how clever it is. And then not only has it tucked itself away in there, but it's perfectly relaxed. It's tucked himself away. He's fast asleep. you know, as if he knows he's got a long 10-month flight ahead of him. And it's just a sort of a good contrast from sort of how it's been during the film. One scene, oh, that always sort of gets me thinking, and I read various things on it as well, is when it kills Victoria Veronica Cartwright's character, and you see like the tail sort of thing come up from behind him and sort of go up in between her legs, as if it's either going to impale her or obviously something else of various whichever way you want to look at it, I suppose. But I don't know if you guys have noticed that scene or think anything of it. Various different sort of ideas behind it, but it seems considering I was killed everybody else by sort of face on and opening his mouth for the little face to come out, you know? It's a very distinctive change in sort of the way it kills him.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I'm not really sure what my thoughts are around that, because obviously there's enough there to suggest something, but not enough to be certain what's actually happened beyond that. But it's another one of those things that adds to the unsettling nature. As you say, you're used to these other ways of it killing people or harming people, and then there's this different dynamic or different way of doing it that it looks like it's using. And I think it just adds another layer of unsettling tension. I think that's something we'll probably talk about more when we do an Aliens pod, because I know we're going to be doing that as well. We're going to be talking more about all the different ways, obviously, the aliens do kill and do harm to different people. So maybe we'll revisit it then. I'm just aware of the time. I'd just like to thank everyone for listening. Thank you both for being great guests. I've really enjoyed this. And just ask you both, where can we find more of your work? Firstly, or your thoughts, starting with Rory.
I'm at Rory Greenfield on Twitter. You can find me on there. I do write football articles regularly for AI, and obviously part of the AI comic pod, and various others at the minute. Quite busy, so all good.
Therefore, I'd recommend anyone to check out Rory's articles and obviously any pods he's on, because obviously, as you can tell, he's a really great talker and got a lot of interesting views. And what about yourself, Jim?
No podcasts, no articles any longer. You catch me on Twitter at JimFish286, where I mainly talk about Liverpool. Been talking a little bit about Sam Allardyce this afternoon, which has wound a few people up. But mainly, I talk about Kinkoid Ladies, which are the football team I'm assistant manager of. So if you like your grassroots football, if you fancy getting involved in women's football at all, give me a shout. We play in the Welsh National Premier League, so we travel all around Wales. Good standard, good set of girls, good side, and we're in pre-season at the moment. So, you can expect plenty of tweets about that and the stresses and trials of tribulations of being in management in football over the next sort of 9 months. And can I just say, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's good to talk to you two guys. You're two very, very good guys. And I look forward to listening to all the future stuff that you do.
Oh, thanks very much, Jim. And best of luck to you and your team for the future. I look forward to hearing how you get on. I'm sure you'll do great. And obviously, to anybody listening, these two guys, I would say, are must follow. So you know what to do on Twitter. And I'd just like to say, as always, thanks for listening. Any feedback, good or bad, film recommendations, I'm on Twitter at JoeSimpson79 or at AI Movie Night. Thanks once again.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.